This is the Rise Up Sea Red podcast, all about the Arizona Cardinals and the NFL, featuring insider and outsider perspectives. Enjoy the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. Now here are your hosts, Jess Root and Seth Cox.
Hello, Arizona Cardinals fans, and welcome to the latest edition of the Rise Up Sea Red podcast. It's episode 238. I'm your host, Jess Root from CardsWire.com. And my co-host is Seth Cox from RevengeOfTheBirds.com, as always. As we record on a Tuesday night, we finally have some real football to discuss. As the Arizona Cardinals opened their season scarily bad and then amazingly fun and then a bit disappointing at the end, they end up with a 27-27 overtime tie with the Detroit Lions. That was a lot of things. And so we're going to talk about this show. So, but before we get started, Seth, just goodness, how does it feel to finally have football back, to finally have seen the Arizona Cardinals offense and to know that, okay, maybe they have a little something?
Yeah, it was a lot of there were a lot of questions through about 2.75 quarters of play, and then all of a sudden it took off like a bolt of lightning, and man, that was fun to watch the last quarter, and then even overtime, and you know, a tie stinks, but at the same time it's impressive that they were able to come back and even get it tied up with where they were heading, you know, into the fourth quarter.
So this episode of the show, what we're going to talk about, we actually have some bad news to share. We're going to talk about first as the Arizona Cardinals have to deal with another offensive line injury, another offseason acquisition injury. So we're going to talk about Marcus Gilbert, his injury. We're going to talk about the addition of Jordan Mills, whom they signed on Tuesday. Then we'll break down the game. How did Kyler do? How did Cliff Kingsbury do in his coaching debut? We're going to talk about the other good things that we saw, some things that concern us. We're going to look ahead to their Week 2 matchup against the Baltimore Ravens, a team that just absolutely decimated the Miami Dolphins on Sunday. Are they as good as they look, or is Miami as bad as they looked? Oh, geez. We're going to talk about that. We'll start with Marcus Gilbert. The Cardinals knew that he was going to be gone in Week 1. He injured his knee on Thursday. Cliff Kingsbury is very consistent. He's given up very, very little when it comes to information about injuries, and he gave up nothing. He wouldn't even say if it needed an MRI. He wouldn't even, like, when the question was, is it bad enough to get an MRI? It's like, I'm not going to get into that. I'm like, seriously. But they gave up nothing. It turns out he tore his ACL, and they finally put him on injured reserve on Tuesday. Justin Murray, a guy they picked up off waivers, was the starter at right tackle. Not terrible at all. He played reasonably well. But they signed a guy in Jordan Mills on Tuesday. Lots of game experience. He's been in the league for quite a while. And started every single game of the last three seasons with the Buffalo Bills, went to the Miami Dolphins in the offseason, and was among their final cuts. And the initial reaction that I think, well, why in the world would we want a guy that the Miami Dolphins cut? We have to take that with a grain of salt, because the Miami Dolphins also just traded away Laremy Tunsil. So I don't know if their goals were to keep the most talented players, or rather just to, hey, let's get some young players. I don't know. So what do you think, first of all, what were your first thoughts on the Marcus Gilbert injury when we knew about it last week? So unfortunately, Marcus Gilbert never even gets to play a game for the Cardinals.
Yeah, you and I talked about this when they traded for him back in March. There was always just that one big caveat: if he can stay healthy. He's just unfortunately a guy that's been injury prone, and we don't know what knee it is even at this point.
Nope.
Okay, so we don't even know if it's the knee that he's struggled with or if it's the opposite knee. I mean, in my learned opinion, it can be either, because, you know, once you start having problems with one knee, it makes it more vulnerable, but then also the other knee becomes more vulnerable because typically you're putting more stress on it. So, you know, at the same time, it's not a shock. It's unfortunate, and it's not anything that, you know, we were expecting to happen this early. Because like Jess said, I mean, did we see Marcus Gilbert as a 16-game starter? No. Did we see Marcus Gilbert as never suiting up for the Arizona Cardinals in the regular season? No. So that's what makes it tough. I mean, you can only go into battle so many times. He's 31, I believe, correct?
That sounds about right. But yeah,
a 31-year-old,
is probably death to his career.
Yeah, he's a 31-year-old. He is he's not a small man. When you look at injuries and you look at situations, guys that are 6'6 and play at a listed weight of 330 pounds, so he's probably closer to what, 340, 350 maybe. I mean, and you're talking about lower body injuries, leg injuries. Like, it's a bad combination. And in the end, it was a 6th-round pick. And so, I mean, it sucks for the Cardinals that they're going to eat $5 million more in salary, because he was on the roster for the first game, so he's guaranteed that salary even with injury. But it also stinks because they really needed him to be a success, at least for the 1 year, while they got, you know, whether it was Justin Murray or Josh Miles or any of, you know, or is it Brandon Toth, the big kid that they signed? Like, they just needed to not have to rush those guys into service, and now that's out the window. And, you know, Justin Murray played, and he did an admirable job for a guy that's never played an NFL game, even though he's been in the league, or 3 years?
Actually been since 2016 he's bounced around, and he appeared in 2 games last year, but... Yeah, he's appeared in 2 games since 2016. The Cardinals, I believe, are his 6th team. And, hey, it finally sticks.
Yeah, and so you just look at it, and it's one of those situations where it's just, I mean, it's not a surprise. And that's what sucks about it, is that I think all of us went into the season really hopeful that it would work out. But at the same time, you just go, I'm not surprised by this at all. And that's kind of what sucks the most.
It's really from the time during the, during training camp, these were conversations that you and I and Blake had in on Twitter. And it felt like, well, this is Evan Mathis again, isn't it? Because he kept having days off. And there was some injury issue, and they tried to just get him through to the preseason game. He played in the preseason, but just like Evan Mathis just a couple years ago, well-respected, very talented offensive lineman, came back for one more year. And what it took, 2 games that he was on injured reserve already. He couldn't ever get healthy. It just feels like the Cardinals just have the dumbest luck when it comes to the offensive line. Steve Kine, you can say whether he's been bad at putting together offenses. It's not for a lack of trying. They've thrown money at guys like Jared Vildier and Mike Iupati and Justin Pugh. They trade for Marcus Gilbert. They draft DJ Humphries. They draft Mason.
I mean,
Cole,
Jonathan Cooper.
Jonathan
Cooper. I mean,
they can't just get it right. And
No, and they've invested. I mean, when you look at it, they've invested three huge contracts in Jared Valdir, Mike Iupati, and now Justin Pugh. And then they've invested, you know, two first round picks, a third round pick, and then
a whole bunch of day three picks. That's a crapshoot. Day three picks are always a crapshoot. You want something to stick eventually.
Right. Usually, but that's the thing is they've never, and that's what's been the biggest problem is that they've never been able to develop anybody because everybody always is getting hurt. And so then they always have to like rush these guys into play, or worse, they have to bury them because they don't get a chance to develop them. And that's what the honest to goodness problem is like, you look at it, you draft a guy who's the big kid out of Vanderbilt they drafted a couple years
Will
ago?
Will Holden.
Will Holden. So you draft Will Holden, who has really impressive measurables from a size and,
athletic. His athletic
quickness.
Profile was incredible.
And he's having to play in the first 10 games? I mean, this is a fifth-round pick that they needed to sit on the bench for a full season and like, mature, and they couldn't even do it. And just, like, that's been what the problem is that –
Well, and then they draft centers that can't beat out A.Q. Shipley because he's freaking resilient. He can't get rid of him.
Well, and to Mason Cole's defense, and you and I talked about this – Mason Cole's biggest weakness was snapping in the shotgun. So, I mean, at the Senior Bowl in 2018, it was an actual conversation that was had amongst scouts of whether he would have to play somewhere else because he was struggling so bad to get shotgun snaps back. So you bring in an air raid and it's all shotgun and like you kind of, you know, at that point just – you're like, oh crap, but like you get what you ask for. I mean, you can't ask a guy that is probably his biggest weakness as a center is shotgun snapping to now shotgun snap 99% of the time. So it's unfortunate. It's just it is what it is. And so, you know, it just is another, like, I don't know how to say this without sounding rash or uncouth, but it's just another, you know, headstone in the graveyard of Steve Keim trying
lineman.
I mean that's all it is, and I hate saying it like that, but this dude, again, not for lack of trying.
Now you can say there's one thing that you can say that he has been guilty of, and that is he's avoided the highest price, the highest talented guys with going with guys. Every single one of these guys that he's picked up, that he's put out, he's given money to or acquired, they've all had durability concerns. Mike Iupati came in that last year. He's a little bit banged up when he was playing for San Francisco. Jared Valdir had missed time with the torn triceps. Justin Pugh had missed 12 games in the previous 2 years. Then you add Marcus Gilbert, who played 12 games in the last two seasons. Really the only – there's been one offensive lineman of any note, of any repute that they've acquired in free agency who has been durable, that's been has a history of durability, is J.R. Sweezy. And people's reaction to signing J.R. Sweezy is, eh.
Yeah, and people were upset about that, and so it kind of, you know, bringing this all back full circle, the signing of Jordan Mills, I mean, what was the one stat you gave us about Jordan Mills the last 3 years?
Every single game of the last 3 years, he started 48 straight games playing right tackle for the Buffalo Bills. That is
so
– that's great!
Yeah, so, I mean, is he – good? I mean, probably – I mean, he's nowhere near as talented as Marcus Gilbert. But the talent of Marcus Gilbert doesn't matter because he can never get on the field. So at that point, it's just – it is what it is, and that's the part they're at now. You and I are speculating. We don't have any inside information on this, but we're speculating that Justin Murray will start this game again, and then it'll kind of be like a best man wins type situation going forward. But I can't imagine that they'll start Jordan Mills on 3 days of practice against the Baltimore Ravens, who are
especially
really good.
Consider this. Look at the amount of time that they gave Michael Crabtree, who plays receiver. And so,
right. So I
would anticipate, I anticipate that they think, so based on this signing, I would anticipate that they plan on Mills being the starter, because simply, I mean, the only start in Murray's career is past Sunday. And as optimistic as they can be about him, they were just as optimistic about Corey Cunningham a year ago, and they just sent him packing. So I anticipate that Mills will end up being the starter. They've been very, very, they've been very positive. They've raved in some ways about Justin Murray. But I think it's talking about a huge upgrade to the roster. But I never thought you can't rave about a player like that and think that he's a starter when he's bounced, when he's on your sixth team in 4 years. So I think they like Murray's ability to come off the bench more than having him as a starter. He did admirably, but then what did Cliff Kingsbury say on Monday is that they had tackles in on Monday. They were working out. So Justin Murray's probably the guy this week, maybe next week. I anticipate Mills will be the guy at some point moving forward.
And he'll be available.
That's something. And here's the thing: if we believe what we've got in Kyler Murray, they do not need a great offensive line. You think of the great quarterbacks in the league. Very few of them have had great offensive lines. When you have a great quarterback, especially once you hit that first big contract, all you've got to have is capable. You've got to have good enough. When Carson Palmer lit up the league in 2015, that offensive line was not good. 2016, when David Johnson set records, there was not a good offensive line. They were barely capable. Kurt Warner, when they went to the Super Bowl, come on. Mike Gandy was nothing special left tackle. Levi Brown was playing right tackle. That was a good enough offensive line. That's what we need moving forward. Coming up next on the Rise of Sea Red podcast, we're going to move to the game, start breaking things down, talk about the performances there. We'll talk specifically about Kyler Murray. That's coming up next on Rise Up Sea Red. We're back on the Rise Up Sea Red podcast. Best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. Let's talk about Kyler Murray. Kyler Murray, ooh, that was a game that really did not look good for a while, and then suddenly it looked great. How worried were you after the first half of play with how Murray was playing?
It's one of those situations where I wasn't worried about his long-term outlook. It was frustrating that there was not more early success. Just because, you'd love to see this kid come out and kind of straight off the bat, straight out of the gate, be really successful, especially since, you and I spent the last month saying things like, oh, they're not showing anything. They've told us this, and they're saving it for the regular season. And then to come out kind of flat and taking their time to get into gear, it was not a whole lot of fun. And so you're sitting there going, should they have shown more in the preseason?
And yeah, that's the thing you had to think about is, and Cliff admitted that. He admitted that afterwards. He's like, well, it's a give and take there. Do you want to not show anything or do you want to rep it? Because if you rep it so that you can execute, but then you've given other defenses a chance to see things. And he chose one way, and well, now that it's on, they probably won't have to keep as much in future preseasons. Because we know the Cliff's going to have at least one more year, right? We know that. But the thing that was interesting about me and Kyler Murray's demeanor has always been the guy doesn't get nervous. It was obvious. It was really obvious that he was, I don't know if overwhelmed or nervous, but his inexperience did come into play because there were times when, like, the interception, that was very rookie-like, and it wasn't Kyler Murray-like, because the analytics show, like, his game tape, he doesn't turn the ball over. And that was just one of those ill-advised throws, the interception in the first half. He was a little off on his throws, the tips at the line of scrimmage, and so kind of everything was coming to, like, oh, he's the first batted down, first ball tipped the line of scrimmage. Oh, he's too short. Like, what? The stat they kept throwing out there when they drafted him, he only had 5 passes batted down his entire last year at Oklahoma. Four, count them, in his debut for the Cardinals. And it was just, he wasn't in rhythm, and it looked worrisome, because this supposedly innovative, high-powered offense was producing at roughly the same level as their garbage offense and scheme from a year ago.
Yeah, and so there was a lot of, kind of questions heading into this about what was going to happen and how it would work out. And then you watch it, and it started off, and you could just tell that there was just not a lot of rhythm. Wide receivers were turning around late, or Murray was early, or Murray was late, and so there was just, I mean, and then the offensive line in the first half wasn't great. Then they would have silly penalties that kind of got them into positions where, I think I saw a stat that came up that said their average, like, third down to go was like 17 yards.
Yeah.
And that was just, I mean,
there's no, that you,
I don't
can't
care
have,
if it's,
it doesn't matter.
Right.
If
I don't care if it's Tom Brady.
Right.
Like, you can't ask a rookie in his first start to overcome that consistently. And so that was really what it was. And I think as they found the running game and they were able to lean on it more, that's really what opened things up, because all of a sudden now you have options. Now you're multiple on second down and third down, as opposed to, well, if we run on second and long because we gave up a sack or had a penalty on first down, now, and we don't get chunk yardage, well, then we're in an obvious passing down. And so that was a lot of the first two and three quarters of the game. And as they got into more of a rhythm and they got into, multiples on second and third down, all of a sudden they were able to kind of bring out the bag of tricks. I think Cliff was able to show a little more of his diversity and that innovation that everybody's talking about so much. And just the way, I mean, just running a double mesh with Christian Kirk running the jet sweep and then David Johnson running, that inside zone, and the defense now has to account for Kirk on the jet. They have to account for David Johnson on his own, and then, oh, by the way, Kyler Murray may actually keep the ball and run. And so all of a sudden things started to open up, and then when that started to work, you started to see the rhythm of Murray. And so it was almost like, it's weird to say this, but it's almost like he needed the run game just to make the defense have to shuffle their feet. And then all of a sudden it was like, oh, okay, now here's my throwing lane. Now here's, we've got the defense going this way, and here's Keyshawn coming back this way. Here's Larry going out this way. Here's Christian going this way. Here's Demir going this way. I mean, he threw to so many people. The targets were so diversified. And then David Johnson as well. It was just, it was fun to see once it actually started going.
So you're saying in old school football, they needed the run to set up the pass. Is that what you're saying? So maybe this offense.
Oh yeah,
maybe this offense is still has some tenets of some basic football. While the passing game can open up the running game, which I believe we've seen, which will contribute to David Johnson's success this year. But the running game also helped open things up. Now, the fourth quarter, something flipped, and I know Cliff referred to some analytics. He wouldn't tell us the numbers. We may have to make us look it up. His fourth quarter numbers in college were something insane, and it seemed like once he hit that big play to Larry Fitzgerald, everything started clicking. It seemed that every receiver was open. Well, and the stats were bad. And then I think I counted he connected on 11 of 12 passes after that. Everything was working. The short, the medium, the longer pass, everything was working for Murray. The accuracy that had left him early in the game, those throws to Fitz, both in regulation and overtime, were just absolutely fantastic. It was like he got his feet under him. He got acclimated to what was happening. And with the help with Cliff's play calling, we saw what potentially is what we can see moving forward, which is super exciting. He made big plays. Now, I have one major observation of what I saw, and it felt to me like he was purposely holding back from running. And that's the one thing that I want to see unlocked, because we know how dynamic is, and he is. And I know there's part of it where he's saying he doesn't want to look like Lamar Jackson a year ago, where it was run first. We know he's not a run-first quarterback, but that is part of his game that is special. And he had three rushing attempts. Now, he was sacked five times. I believe two of those sacks that were credited for were basically rushes that went negative. He either gave up or went out of bounds. So they counted as sacks because it was kind of a pass play, but they were really essentially rushes. There was really only two plays where I felt he was trying to gain yards. There was the one, and then the other one that he ended up not getting the first down on, because he, instead of pushing the ball forward, he had it behind him. And I just felt like he was purposely, whether it's being coached or whatever, he's trying to prove something, he's holding back his legs.
Yeah, and I feel like it's probably being coached at this point, because it seems like it's a conscious effort to make sure you're not running, which is just, I mean, that's silly to me. Like, be dynamic, let the kid out of, you know, and develop into who he is as a player, you know, and let that be a multiple option type of guy, a guy that can do different things. And so, you know, at that point, you just kind of, you look at it and you hope that they're a little more freeing of him, as the season goes on, and that they're able to kind of, you know, grow, a little bit more from that and be a little more willing to let him be himself and be kind of take some chances and take some risk and things of that nature.
So here's the thing. While sure, they're holding him back, or he's holding himself back with the running attack, there's one thing that's clear. They're not really trying to protect him in the pass game. They have opened everything up. 54 pass attempts. It's a top 10 passing attempt performance in Cardinals history. 54 pass attempts in his debut. I think Josh Rosen threw the ball in the most last year was 43. And that was when they were, I mean, think about it. The games that they were in, they had no choice but to throw the ball. I think Carson Palmer was the last to throw 50 times, and that was in October of 2017. And 54 is the most since, I believe it was 2008 or 2009. Kurt Warner was the last to throw for that many passes. 300 yards in his debut with two touchdown passes. Oh, goodness. He's going to... Now, assuming as we see, maybe it won't be as great as it was in the fourth quarter, but it certainly won't be as bad as it was the first three quarters. Maybe we can see, is he going to really put up video game numbers in the passing game?
It sure does seem like it. I mean, I was slightly like you, disappointed in his rushing numbers. And so even if you take away, you know, fifth, and it'll be crazy, you know, it sounds crazy, but even if you take away like 58 of those yards and you put them in rushing, like we're talking about now, I don't expect him to average 71 yards a game. That would be, you know, over 1,000 yards on the season. Like that's crazy. So, but if he was at 50, you know, 58 yards a game and 250 yard, you know, 50 yards rushing and 250 yards passing, that's 4,000 yards on throwing, and then
800 yards on the ground.
Yeah, you're talking about nearly 5,000 yard performance as a rookie, and so, you know, and again, we're not saying two passing touchdowns a game, but if you're talking about two total touchdowns a game, I think that's fair. You're talking, you know, maybe 4,500 total yards and 30 total touchdowns, to, you know, that 14-15 interception type thing. I think that's realistic. And so are those video game numbers? Well, yeah, but like you said, when you're talking about 40, well, in general, when you're talking about probably he's going to, I mean, five sacks, three rushing attempts, 54 passes. So you're talking about 62 times he had the ball in his hands to make a play in the game. He's going to put up numbers. And that's kind of what we were talking about with the points and, you know, and stuff off the air, is like, it's just by sheer force of numbers that they're going to, you know, have this year. They're going to have success. The hope is that it's spread out a little better over the course of a game, and it's not in a furious comeback form week in and week out.
Coming up next on the Rise Up Sea Red podcast, we'll talk more about Cliff Kingsbury, his performance, and what he did offensively, well, with the offense. That's coming up next on the Best Hour Cardinals Talk on the Web, the Rise Up Sea Red podcast. We're back on the Rise Up Sea Red podcast, the Best Hour Cardinals Talk on the Web. Kyler Murray aside, Cliff Kingsbury's performance, we got to see the offense. We got to see his decision-making. Let's talk about what we saw offensively. He said he got too cute early in the game, but just let look at the pick game at the whole. Was what we saw on the field what we expected? Was that the case for you? And not necessarily for the production for the first three quarters, but with what they did offensively, the personnel groups, the play calls, was that more or less what you were expecting, or did you expect something a little different?
No, I mean, that's what we were expecting. We were expecting to see, you know, different sets, different looks, different personnel groupings. We were expecting to see them take a different look in terms of offensive styles. I mean, we saw them go power. We saw them go spread. We saw them go no back, five wide. The whole idea behind the air raid is to put pressure on the defense and numbers. And that's what we saw, I think, the most this game, is that pressure is created on the defense by changing your personnel, by changing your formations, and by creating mismatches with David Johnson on, you know, a 4-3 linebacker. I mean, that's who he caught the touchdown over was Jalen Reeves Maven or something like that. I mean, he's their fourth string linebacker. So it's the young kid out of Florida that they drafted after Hassan Reddick was drafted. I can't remember his name now. And then Christian Jones, and then the kid they drafted this year out of Hawaii that had a pretty nice game. And then it's Reeves Maven. And so you look at it, and that's what it's all about. It may not be, oh, we're calling the play for that. And I thought Kyle Odegaard did a nice job in his column today kind of breaking that down, that the play call wasn't to get David Johnson on a seam route. It just lined up because of personnel. And so that's what the whole idea behind the air raid is to create, you know, options for your quarterback and win in sheer volume and numbers in that way. And I think that's what we saw. I mean, I'm not going to be surprised if we see, I mean, it's never going to, I shouldn't say never, but it's not going to be two or three quarters every game. But I won't be surprised if we see slow starts in several games this year where they're trying to, you know, find the right groupings and take advantage of the right matchups. And then, you know, on the fourth or fifth series of the game, then they find it, and now all of a sudden they're able to really exploit it and attack it.
For me, what I saw, and it becomes very clear to me that Cliff Kingsbury is all about just making things difficult for defenses. He doesn't. It starts with things as benign as whenever it's possible, especially like the beginning of a possession, rather than having the offensive unit already back in the huddle, he delays that. So he has them huddling near the sideline so the defense can't know exactly what personnel group is going out. They sub very quickly, and they kind of a college type thing, because you can't have more than 11 players in or around the scrimmage. And so there are receivers, they will have 13, 14 players on the field, but really out on the outskirts of the side of the field for substitution purposes. So it just makes it very, very difficult for the defense to know what personnel package to put out there. And then they go with tempo. You could tell at least, and I can think that the Cliff was trying to be a little too cute on some things, is where they would line up in one formation that suggests this and do something else. A perfect example of that is when David Johnson didn't get the touchdown, when he didn't get that touchdown, and it's second and goal or first and goal or whatever, inside the two, like inside the one, they line up in a superpower package. So they have no receivers on the field. Technically, I call it a 14 personnel. They've got David Johnson in the backfield. You've got two tight ends, and you've got two extra offensive linemen. You've got Mason Cole and Joshua Miles in the game, which screams, it screams run the ball up the middle or some sort of power running play, and then they run a pass play in the perimeter or with a they do this thing like that, and then another play where they come in another jumbo package and they run a jet sweep. And it was like they were doing things to kind of throw the defense off. There are things that I really liked. They did a lot of spread. They did a lot of spreading the field. The idea of 10 personnel that was talked about all summer, and I downplay, I'll say that I was wrong, because I thought that they would have to go with more 11 personnel going with a tight end on the field all the time. And the truth is, The guy that got on the field the most, they only had 36 snaps of the 82 where there was any tight end on the – there were only 36 tight end snaps in the entire game. They went with four wide receivers, over 50 different snaps, roughly 67% of their snaps. And I think I saw a tweet where there were four wide receivers on the field, 44 instances in the entire league outside of the Cardinals game. So they really are trying to, here's the thing that seems smart to me. What's one of the areas that's the hardest to keep good depth at? And that's a defensive back. If you put four receivers on the field, you're taking linebackers and defensive linemen off the field, positions which are typically a little deeper, that you can scheme more for, and then you're putting defensive backs on the field. You're putting a third-string safety or a fourth-string cornerback. That's going to work out for you at some point if you're running your routes correctly and making your reads correctly, unless it's schemed perfectly. I like that they would spread things out. Sometimes it's had Max Williams and Charles Clay, but they wouldn't be lined up in line. They'd be out on the perimeter. They'd be in the slot or out wide. And so it just creates different challenges for the defense. And in terms of formations, it was as creative as I think we expected them, because we saw a variety of formations, a variety of motions, movements, and it was all in the sense they're trying to deceive the defense and just make it really tough for them.
Yeah, and what it did is it allowed guys like Keyshawn Johnson to get, you know, a lot of targets. It allowed Demir Byrd to get targets because, I mean, I think back to that. I think it was third down. It might have been fourth down. I can't remember. But it was the play to Demir Byrd, and it was after a big play to Larry, and Kent Summers tweeted out, you know, if I'm the Cardinals, I'm looking to Larry on this play. And then they went to Demir Byrd, and it was just like that wonderful, it was that wonderful, like, 12-yard hitch where Byrd ran him off, and he came out of his break, and the ball's literally waiting for him to just, you know, to catch, and that was that. And that is what, you know, kind of the whole thing with the air raid is like, okay, who's Darius Slay on? Oh, Darius Slay's on Larry Fitzgerald. Well, you and I talked about Darius Slay last week. He's not just good. He's literally an all-pro corner. I mean, he's a fantastic player. And so when that happens, you are able to say, okay, where's, as Jess pointed out, we're four wide or we're five wide. Okay, who's the weak corner? And then that's where you go to. And so when you see that, that's how this offense is creating mismatches and is able to do different things. And that's what, you know, I think we saw the best part of the offense in game one. I think that's what Cliff was able to do well.
In terms of game strategy, the end of the game, some suggested they should have in overtime gone for it. I was totally okay with the decision to punt, especially since it was at 4th and 7. Play for the tie, say what you will. They put themselves in a position to, one, not lose easily, and two, trusted the defense that maybe they can make something happen, and it almost did. In terms of other strategies and things like that, did you feel that Cliff did a good job overall?
You know, I thought he was a little less aggressive than I was expecting. And maybe that's just the first game jitters as well. Like, you've heard that he was going to change things and be kind of innovative. And one of the innovative things is aggression, because the NFL tends to just be so conservative. They tend to, you know, always, I don't want to say always, but they tend to play to lose more than they play to win. And so I was just hoping to see whether it was that fourth down play or other fourth down plays, especially fourth and shorts that we saw a couple times, with how well and effective the running game was. I would have liked to have seen them be a little more aggressive in those situations. In the end, it worked out in you know, because they were able to come back, make the comeback complete, tie the game. I mean, it's unfortunate that it ends in a tie, but it's a lot better than ending in a loss. And so when you look at it from that perspective, you can't critique too much because of the outcome. I mean, but in the same conversation, you look at it and you just say, hey, like, it would have been great to see him be just slightly more aggressive.
Coming up next on the Rise Up Secret podcast, we're going to talk about other factors in the game. What other things did we like that we saw? That's kind of next on Rise Up Sea Red. We're back on the Rise Up C-Red podcast, the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. Talking now about the other parts that we – what are other good things that we saw? For me, one of the biggest things – now, the defensive numbers were not impressive. Like, if you look at the volume, the Cardinals gave up 27 points. They gave up almost 500 total yards. They gave up over 380 passing yards. They gave up over 100 yards on the ground. Two different receivers had over 100 yards in receiving yards. But you feel like the defense actually did some things nice. The corner, despite the really gaudy bad passing numbers, the passing game held up pretty well. There were plays made. Three sacks. You got a sack from Chandler Jones and a fumble recovery. You get two sacks from Terrell Suggs. You get some solid play from Jordan Hicks was super active. I thought that the defense performed better than the numbers say, which was good to see, especially when you have when you were dealing with Tremaine Brock as one of your starting corners and having to have Joe Walker at linebacker. And it was not a great performance, but
no.
They were better than the numbers were, because they held him 33% on third down. They pressured Matthew Stafford on almost half of his passing attempts. And you take Matthew Stafford's rushing yards away and you've got a real respectable rushing performance.
Yeah, and that's the whole thing, is you look at it, you're never going to shut down a team. I mean, one, there's not enough talent. Like, let's just be completely honest. There's just not enough talent. And so when you look at it from that perspective, you go into, okay, well, what did we do well? Well, they gave up a ton of pass yards, but they also had multiple sacks, multiple sack fumbles. They were able to, like you said, do a good job when they did get into third down situations, holding them in third down situations. And here's the thing. Three of the plays were on busted coverages. One was the Amendola touchdown was on a busted coverage. The Kenny Golladay touchdown was on a busted coverage. And then the TJ Hawkinson touchdown was on a busted coverage. So you look at it and you go, okay, well, who were the guys in coverage? Well, Tremaine Brock, I believe, was the guy on Amendola. I could be wrong, but I'm pretty sure it was Brock on Amendola, and he got lost. He basically just got lost in the field. Okay, so a veteran, a long-term veteran, a guy that knows Vance Joseph's defense got lost. Then on the Kenny Golladay touchdown, Byron Murphy got lost. He had no idea where Golladay went to, and that was on him. And then in the third one, I don't know, there were three guys that were lost. Like, how does the one weapon get behind you? So those were three, like, huge plays. Not just in terms of, like, the outcome of the game, but those were three, like, long plays outside. The Golladay one was only 10 yards, but it was at a very critical point where a field goal was, was a big win for the team. And you look at it and you go, okay, I can live with the results based on the fact that, I mean, there were three times where they were lost.
Yeah. Another positive for me was the kicking. I mean, special teams, they were fantastic. Andy Lee had one bad punt. They were in position. Trent Sherfield and Kevin Peterson were both in position to down a punt inside the five that they just couldn't do. They just messed up. But they did good in punt coverage. Zane Gonzalez was again fabulous. He hasn't missed in a game this year, preseason or regular season.
What's funny? After he was just awful.
In the red and white?
In the red and white.
He's been so great.
He is like, it was like he needed to suck that day. And that's what's funny is like, because that's where you and I were vocally concerned the whole offseason. Why don't they have another guy? Like, just have a
somebody.
Guy. Somebody. and then the red and white happened, and we were like, oh, this is clearly an issue. And then it was like from there, it was lasered in. Like, he's been one of the best kickers in the NFL. And then you add to that Indy Isabella. He was okay on kickoff returns, about 21.5 yards average. Christian Kirk, again, was okay on punt returns. I thought the punt return and kick return blocking were the weakest part of a great special teams weekend. And when that's your complaint, man, doesn't that feel like just 180 different than a couple of years ago?
Right. And Football Outsiders listed them as they had the top special teams performance of the week. Other positives, we were talking about this before the show, the running game. David Johnson's usage looks 2016-ish. I mean, it didn't feel like he had a dominant game, but at the end of the day, he had almost 140 total yards. He rushed for 82, 18 carries. That you'll take that every week. In fact, if you extrapolate that out, you project that out to a whole season, that's 1,300 yards on the ground if he's averaging over 80 yards a game. I mean, that's not even like a big game. He averaged over 4.5 yards a carry. He had 6 catches for 55 yards. So the 137 yards extrapolated throughout a season is nearly 2,200 yards from scrimmage. That's better than his 2016 season. And the way they ran the ball, because and I charted this out in the offseason, 2016, it was boom or bust a lot of the way. He had a ton of negative runs in 2016. They had a bad line. He also had a lot of big plays. Last year, he still had a productive-ish year. It was a boring productive at 940 yards. They almost eliminated the negative plays.
Yeah, it was three. It was clear. It was like a weird 3 yards and a cloud of dust.
But there was nothing explosive. So he was like getting 2 and 3 yards a pop with nothing big. David Johnson might have a big year, and he doesn't look quite as the way he runs. It looks like he's forgotten how to run like he did in 2016. Maybe it's being coached out of him. Maybe it's just because they have a different coaching staff. But I think we're going to be excited for what David Johnson does this year. And maybe it's just the sheer volume. If you're doing that many offensive plays, there's going to be a lot of big numbers.
Yeah, and you look at, I mean, Larry Fitzgerald had 8 catches. I went back. He only had one game last year where he had that many catches and had over 10 yards per reception. So that was, you know, it wasn't just a volume dump into Fitzgerald. It was, you know, it was productive long yardage. It was good to see. It was something we haven't seen from him in a while. Not anything of his doing, I would guess, but it was good to see, you know, a little bit different usage for Larry. And he was super productive in a game where they needed somebody to make plays, and he was able to. That was really good to see. I think another old guy that really played well was Terrell Suggs. I mean, 2 sacks. I think he had 7 quarterback hits as well.
2 tackles for loss. So he was active, and he played in, what, 77% of the snaps?
Yeah,
I don't know if he's going to play that much, but he was productive through the whole game.
I think he'll be a 70-75% type of guy. I mean, you figure they're just, you know, they were just working in. Who is the guy they just brought in? Goodness. Cassius Marsh. You know, so they haven't even really got him accustomed to it yet. So it's really just Brooks Reed this week that was getting the kind of secondary pass rush stuff. So now you'll get a little bit more Cassius and a little less Suggs, and I think it'll help both guys. I mean, obviously he's not going to have 32 sacks on the season, but even if he can go, you know,
to 10 double digit sacks for someone his age, 37-year-old. Oh my gosh,
that's insane. So I mean, it was great. I mean, we can never talk enough about Chandler Jones and that's just a fact. I think he's I think it was Joe Thomas that tweeted it out. I wish I could remember during the game. But it was, you know, that Chandler Jones is a top five player at his top five pass rusher in the NFL and one of the most underrated players in the NFL. And that's weird to say.
Other than that, coming up next to the Rise FC Red podcast, let's talk about some of our concerns before we move forward and look ahead to the game against Baltimore. So look into this coming up next on the Rise FC Red. We're coming up next on the Rise FC Red podcast, the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. Here we are now. There were still concerns. What is your major concerns that you have still coming out of that game? Things are like, that probably could do a little bit better. What stood out to you as concerning?
I think when you look at this game overall, the biggest concern is going to continue to be, even though they played well with the offensive line, can they get into a rhythm quick enough? They struggled early on, and then they've really, I think about the third quarter, they started to really wear down the defensive line, and they started to get some positive running plays, and that, you know, like we talked about, that was able to create positive passing plays. And so I think that was the biggest thing is for me, especially with Baltimore coming up, like they still started slow that way. And so can they play a full four quarters like they did in the second half? That was because the second half, I mean, they played really well. And I think a lot of it was, you saw the J.R. Sweezy thing, but I think a lot of that had to do with he was so worried about Justin Murray, and he was going to help Justin Murray in so many snaps that like it caused a problem. And so I think that's the biggest thing. Are, you know, if they go to Jordan Mills this early, like, is there going to be the same type of issue to start with? Or if they stay with Justin Murray, are they going to be able to kind of continue what was a really positive second part of the game?
My main concern is simply defensively is we got to get Hassan Reddick back out there. As crazy as that sounds, they need Reddick out there. Joe Walker, he's a capable guy, but they need Reddick out there for his athleticism and ability to cover guys because – and it was interesting because it looked like they were really going to hold Reddick back. Joe Walker was playing almost all – Reddick was only going in for specific packages when it looked like it was a clear passing down situation, and they either asked him to rush the passer or to play in space in coverage. After Joe Walker got burned on that T.J. Hockenson play, Reddick was in there for a lot, and he ended up playing more than Walker, 52 snaps to 86, and I was surprised. But I think if Reddick isn't able to play right away or get to that 100% level that the linebackers usually play in this defense, that's my major concern because Hicks played well. If Reddick's out there, you at least have someone to keep up with the athletic tight ends that are around.
Yeah, and that was a problem this week. And guess what? Baltimore has two of those guys. And Mark Andrews and Hayden Hurst. So that and Lamar Jackson threw them roughly 90 passes on last Sunday. So, you know, that's a huge thing this coming week. I think, you know, the other concern is you have to be concerned with the blown assignments that we talked about. We talked about basically every corner that had an assignment, blew an assignment at least once, and they all led to big plays. And so that's the thing is, like, we understand there's going to be growing pains and things of that nature, but, like, are the blown assignments going to always result in touchdowns? Like, that's the thing is, like, if you're going to blow your assignment, it can't be for a big play. And I know that sounds like contradictory, but like, if you blow your assignment, can you recover? Or because that was the thing, is like the Amendola and the Galladay touchdown, there were literally nobody within 20 yards of them. I mean, there's just nobody close to them. So, you know, that doesn't give you a chance to compete. If you make an assignment or, you know, error, at least give yourself a chance to compete still. And that's the biggest thing. Like, or can you cut it down to just two blown assignments in a game instead of three that lead to touchdowns? Simple.
And even the Hawkinson touchdown was a mistake because they had, I think, four guys in the end zone in coverage.
And none of them went.
None of them followed Hawkinson.
Yeah. Yeah, none of them went to the back line. It was like, that's like scramble drill 101. So that's the thing, is you really want to, that's what you kind of want to see, is like, hey, let's cut down on the big, you know, the big errors, because they're going to make mistakes. It's game two of the season against a really good team. They're going to make mistakes. I guarantee you. But it's how do we minimize those mistakes?
Coming next on the Rise Up C-Red podcast, the final segment of the show, we're going to talk about the Ravens, coming up next on the Rise Up C-Red podcast. We're back on the Rise Up C-Red podcast, best hour of Cardinals talking Red. We're going to wrap this up talking about the next matchup the Cardinals have against the Ravens, who are heavy favorites. They blew the doors off the Miami Dolphins 59-10.
What? In Miami.
Now, granted, this Miami team is terrible. They are bad. But Lamar Jackson threw five touchdown passes, 324 yards. When was it on? It was under 30 pass attempts. How do you do that? They rushed for 265 yards. They threw for 378. This is ridiculous. Robert Griffin came into the game and threw for 55 yards and a touchdown. They threw six touchdown passes. And they still have a very talented defense. They lost Eric Weddle, but guess who they replaced him with? Earl Thomas.
Yeah. They lost a Pro Bowl All-Pro safety and then added a Hall of Fame safety. So, you know, things are going well for them.
So they're favored by 13.5. Where do you see the matchups? Because this is going to be an intriguing game. I don't think the Ravens are as good offensively as they showed last week, because Miami is just
record setting.
Like, they're a dumpster fire, but they do have, I mean, they run the ball. They were a great running team last year, and they did that without Lamar Jackson running. Here's a fun fact. Matthew Stafford, with his 22 rushing yards, outrushed Kyler Murray and Lamar Jackson combined. That doesn't make any sense at all.
Yeah, and so this is a team that is just, like you said, they're incredibly versatile. They can run you over and run it down your throat, or they can spread you out and throw the ball around.
They've got some really good tight ends. They've got now, with the addition of Marquise Brown, that opens up another facet of the offense that he didn't really have.
Marquise Brown and was it Miles Boykin, the other rookie for them. So like you look at it, they have a ton of talent, and they're going to be a team that is really going to be difficult to defend consistently, because they've got so much. They do have so much talent. They're able to do, you know, attack you in different ways. And so the question becomes, can you create enough offensively to play with them? I think they can. And that's my big thing, is like, I see a team in the Cardinals that are versatile, that are able to really play in different ways. But that's going to be the biggest thing, is they got to find a way to compete consistently in different ways, and not get down behind, because the difference between the Ravens and the Lions is, if you get down 28-0, they're just going to you're going to get a really heavy dose of
Mark Ingram.
Mark Ingram and who's the other guy they have? I can't remember his name, but yeah, I mean, you're going to see two guys that are just going to run the ball down your throat, and they're not afraid to do that, and that's just kind of how they are as players, so or as a team. And then, you know, obviously, I mean that team that they played in the Dolphins is, it could be historically bad. So you look at it and you acknowledge how good the win was, and then you wonder what they can do, because I don't think it's indicative of how good the Ravens defense is, more than it is just how bad the Dolphins offense is.
Yeah. Matchups that are going to cause problems. I think Marquise Brown's going to be an interesting guy to watch.
He's definitely going to test the deep speed of this team. And that is one thing we've talked about, that, you know, when you look at the Lions, as much as you were slightly concerned by Kenny Golladay and Marvin Jones, they weren't burners. They weren't guys that are going to beat you over the top. I mean, Marquise Brown is fast, and I think that's putting it like super mildly. And so, you know, can Byron Murphy, Chris Jones, and Tremaine Brock keep up?
And it's going to be interesting to see what the Earl Thomas effect is on Kyler Murray, because Thomas is a game changer defensively. He does different things. He was really kind of the linchpin of that Seattle defense and why they were so good. Obviously, he had Bobby Wagner, but Earl Thomas was the difference maker. It's what made that team really, that took them from being a good defense to be an amazing defense. And if he'll be able to fool Kyler with his play out there, it's safety.
Yeah, and he may be able to, and that's, you know, kind of the concerning thing is what he's able to do. You know, he's a very difficult defensive player, and so that, and then you look at their defensive line, they're very stout up front. So how are they going to kind of go about this? It's going to be really interesting to see how they attack. They're really going to have to find a way to be creative, to keep the ball away from guys like Earl Thomas and Tony Jefferson, and they're going to have to find a way to take advantage of matchups. I think their corners are, Marlon Humphreys is a really good corner, but I think that I don't know if they can compete, you know, with these guys. So for like what we saw earlier, where they're competing at an extremely high level. So we'll see how this kind of all plays out. I don't expect the Cardinals to win. But I do expect them to play good enough to be in the game and have a chance to win. Even if they don't win, though, you know, that's kind of all you really are asking for, right?
Basically, it's with that first early time slot across the country on the East Coast, and heavily big underdogs, 13.5 points. If you can keep it within a score, obviously you want the Cardinals to win. But if you, based on what we saw from the Ravens last week, if the Cardinals could keep this a one-score game, ideally, I think that really sets them up for some success over the next few games.
Yeah, and the thing is, when you look at it, they were able to come back. They were able to put pressure on the Lions and inevitably tie them. Unfortunately, a tie. But when you look at this, they have a real opportunity with just the way that the schedule played out that we were kind of concerned with to start with, where they could go on a mini you know, little winning streak after this game if they're able to stay competitive. And that's a big if. I mean, that's a giant if. If you go into Baltimore and just get blown out, it's going to be hard to come back and see you competing against Carolina and Seattle, even though they're at home. However, if you go and you compete and you play well, then all of a sudden you're very, you feel better and you feel a little more confident that you can beat a Carolina team that, you know, lost at home to the LA Rams, and that you can beat a Seattle team that struggled against the Cincinnati Bengals. So, you know, those are games that you feel slightly better about if you come out of this game with a close, you know, a close loss, or, I mean, heck, even a win. But if you get, if you get, you know, just run over, all of a sudden you're back to being concerned again.
What do you predict? I predict a 34-30 loss.
Yeah, I think something around, you know, like a 33-28 loss is probably going to be what we're going to see.
And with that, let's wrap this up, this show, the Rise Up Sea Red podcast. We'll be back in a week where we talk about what happened against the Ravens. So thanks for listening. As always, that's Seth Ox. I'm Jess Root. You can find us anywhere that you can find podcasts online. Again, thanks for listening. We'll be back again in a week.
Thanks for listening to the latest edition of the Rise Up Sea Red podcast. Listen to previous episodes and subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher Radio, Audioboom, or many other podcast platforms so shows are delivered directly to your mobile device. Please give the show a 5-star rating and always support the sponsors who support the show. We'll be back soon for the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. Rise up, Red Sea, be Red Sea Red, and of course, Rise Up, Sea Red.